From the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, the U.S. releases photos of the bloodied, bearded bodies of Uday and Qusay Hussein. We'll have a report from Baghdad.
Congress releases its investigation of intelligence leading up to the 9/11 attacks, and the relatives of victims meet with the FBI.
Also, Iran admits it is holding several top al-Qaeda figures, with speculation that Osama's number two man is among them.
Al-Zawahiri is an Egyptian, and there are fairly credible reports that Iran has in fact been conducting discussions with the Egyptians about returning him to Egypt.
These stories and the Bard hits the boards, summer through fall, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. The U.S. military has released photos showing the bodies of Saddam Hussein's two sons who were killed in the battle with U.S. forces in Mosul on Tuesday. NPR's Ivan Watson has more from Baghdad.
Within moments of their release, English and Arabic 24-hour satellite news channels were broadcasting the photographs. The images show close-ups of the gashed and blood-spattered heads of Saddam Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay. During their months on the run, they both grew thick, dark beards, and one had shaved his head. American officials here say they made the unprecedented decision to release images of the corpses after many Iraqis expressed skepticism about Tuesday's announcement that Saddam's sons had in fact been killed during a long gun battle in the city of Mosul. Uday and Qusay were the second and third former Iraqi officials on the U.S. Most Wanted list. For many Iraqis, the eldest son, Uday, was one of the most hated and feared figures in Saddam Hussein's regime. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush says the deaths of Saddam Hussein's sons are good news for the Iraqi people.
Saddam Hussein's sons were responsible for torture, for maiming innocent citizens, and for the murder of countless Iraqis. And now more than ever, the Iraqis can know that the former regime is gone and is not coming back.
The president spoke in Philadelphia, where he's kicking off a month-long effort to promote and defend his economic policies. An Israeli policeman shot and killed a Bedouin man in southern Israel today after the man refused to stop his vehicle for a routine security check. NPR's Linda Gradstein has that story.
An Israeli police spokesman said the circumstances leading up to the shooting have yet to be clarified and the matter is now being investigated. On Tuesday, police on alert for a potential terrorist in a white Subaru car shot and killed an Israeli Arab traffic offender, believing him to be the terrorist. Police said the 28-year-old man failed to stop at an Israeli checkpoint and then ignored warning shots police fired in the air. Meanwhile, a 40-year-old Israeli man was slightly injured in a stabbing attack last night at the entrance to the Shuafat refugee camp in Jerusalem. The man said he was attacked by four Palestinian teenagers who stabbed him as he was bicycling home. Police said they arrested several suspects. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stocks are trading higher this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are up 48 points to 92.42 in heavy trade. The Nasdaq is up 13 points to 17.32, and the S&P is up about 6. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Labor Department says the number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits declined this week for the second week in a row. New jobless claims dipped to a seasonally adjusted 386,000, the first time since early February that they've fallen below the 400,000 level. The less volatile four-week average also fell, reaching its lowest level since early March. Wall Street is awash in quarterly earnings reports today. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports most of the statements are positive.
Analysts had been looking to these earnings reports as a measure of how companies are doing in a variety of sectors. Andy Brooks says he's impressed with the numbers so far. He's head of equity trading at T. Rowe Price and says this quarter saw winners in a wide array of industries.
And what's striking in all this is really how broad the improvement is in the economy, I think.
Dow Chemical, Bristol Myers, JetBlue, J.P. Morgan, and Citigroup all reported better numbers than expected this quarter. Brooks says that bodes well for the future.
If you combine these good earnings with perhaps a return to sanity in the bond market, we're really we're positioning ourselves for a little bit better market.
But Brooks says that even if the market just holds on to its gains from last quarter, it would still be a great year in the market. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, the nation's third largest supermarket chain, Safeway, says its second quarter profits declined sharply due to slower sales growth and competition from discounter Walmart. Safeway says its quarterly net income fell to 36 cents a share. That compares with earnings of 62 cents a share during the same quarter a year ago. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. military made the decision today to release images of the bloodied, battered bodies of Uday and Qusay Hussein, the two sons of Saddam Hussein, who were killed in a firefight earlier this week. The Bush administration hopes the pictures will serve as proof to skeptical Iraqis that the two indeed are dead. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad for initial reaction is USA Today correspondent Andrea Stone. And Andrea, have you seen the pictures yet?
I haven't seen the pictures yet, no.
Well, here on American television, they're being broadcast on CNN. They're pretty gruesome. What was the thinking before today? I mean, was there a sense of how Iraqis might react to seeing these photographs?
I think there's a real cultural difference between the American and Western sensibilities and here in the Middle East. These are the kind of pictures that you don't see printed in the paper and you don't see on TV usually. Maybe in the tabloids, but certainly not in the mainstream press. So I think it's with a lot of, there was a lot of thought given to this because the thinking is that this would really offend a lot of Americans. But it's not really aimed at Americans. It's aimed at Iraqis who are very skeptical about whether Qusay and Uday really were killed on Tuesday in that firefight. So I think they feel that they have to release these pictures to give more credence to it for Iraqis.
Well, there was also a fear that they would be seen as sort of waving around, the picture of a dead person, the shades of Mogadishu with a soldier, an American soldier being dragged through the streets, and American officials didn't want to be perceived that way.
Quite the same thing. I mean, these are pictures of two pieces, basically, and I haven't seen the pictures, but I imagine that they're, I don't know if you ever remember the picture of John Dillinger, those pictures were released, and it was kind of just a dead person. It's different than having a mob drag an American soldier on, TV, live. I think it's a whole different thing.
It's as you said, proof for some people. But how would Iraqis see these pictures now that they've been released? How many have televisions?
A lot of Iraqis have. The one is all over Baghdad are TV satellite dishes. And it was clear Tuesday night when Al Jazeera announced a little precipitously that the men were dead. The whole city erupted in gunfire, celebratory gunfire. So people are very plugged in.
Andrea, is the reaction in Mosul, do you expect, going to be different from the reaction in Baghdad?
It's interesting you mentioned Mosul. Three soldiers were killed early this morning in Mosul, soldiers from the 101st. And it was surmised that this might have been a revenge attack because it was the 101st, that carried out the raid. But officials here in Baghdad today said no, there was no connection. They weren't even sure if the soldiers who were killed were involved in the Tuesday raid.
But what do you expect the reaction in Baghdad to be to the photographs?
I think for some people it will confirm that the S&P they are dead. For other people who don't want to believe it, they'll find a reason not to believe it. I understand that the two men had grown very heavy beards to disguise themselves. And, you know, people will say that's not them. That's not what they look like in life. So, you know, you can believe whatever you want to believe depending on your viewpoint.
Andrea, thank you.
Okay, my pleasure.
Andrea Stone, correspondent for USA Today, speaking to us from Baghdad.
The 900-page report on the intelligence and communication lapses that led to the events of September 11, 2001, was released today. The report, the result of a probe by the House and Senate Intelligence Committee, shows failures at the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency. Senator Richard Shelby, a Republican from Alabama, concluded there was no one smoking gun, but the report is damning.
Put it all together collectively, perhaps things could have been changed on September the 11th. That's hindsight. We'll never know that. But at the same time, I think the report points out a lack of cooperation, the lack of mission at times by a couple of the intelligence agencies.
Another senator, Bob Graham, a Democrat from Florida, was asked on the CBS Early Show if the attacks could have been prevented.
I think the answer is probably yes. The most significant set of events, in my opinion, are in the section of the report that has been censored and therefore won't be available to the American people.
The material Graham is referring to that he says was censored concerns the role of Saudi Arabia, information reportedly deleted from the report at the request of the Bush administration. Beverly Eckert of Stamford, Connecticut, now joins us from Washington, D.C. Ms. Eckert is with the group Voices of September 11th. Her husband, Sean Rooney, was at work on September 11th at the World Trade Center. Ms. Eckert was on the telephone with her husband as he tried to make his way to the roof of the South Tower. Ms. Eckert, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. What were you told this morning when you and other families met with FBI Director Robert Mueller?
Well, the meeting we had with Director Mueller was already scheduled, and it just so happened that it coincided with the release of the Joint Intelligence Committee's report.
Uh-huh.
So he actually began, the main purpose of the meeting was to tell us what the FBI has done to make changes to be a better agency since 9/11. We did talk a little bit about what was in the report, but to my mind, you know, both objectives were equally important.
Yeah, now, Beverly, given what Director Mueller said, and based on what you know about the congressional report, do you feel you have major new insight into how 9/11 happened?
No, I think there's a lot that you know, hasn't come to light yet, and certainly since Senator Graham mentioned that some censored material is critical to our understanding of what happened, then that's pretty discouraging. I'm also discouraged that, and I haven't read the report myself, it was just released at 8:30 this morning, but that it is subject to interpretation, that some people say, conclude that 9/11 could have been prevented, and some conclude 9/11 couldn't have been prevented by reading the material there. I think we should all be concerned that if the report lacks that kind of specificity and clarity, then I don't know that we're any better off than we were before.
Well, are you saying then that the government's not coming clean?
Well, I think the government is still protecting some of the information that would be harmful to it. They talked about information relating to the Saudis, but I also believe there was information relating to a White House briefing that is not fully disclosed in the report, or that the American public can't, won't have access to it. So, I want to believe that things have changed. Certainly, Director Mueller is a breath of fresh air. I mean, he's treating the FBI like a corporation that needs a turnaround. He's brought in outsiders. He's brought in non-FBI career people. We were introduced to a gentleman today who came out of retirement from the FBI. He just said, I wanted to do something after 9/11. I knew the FBI was antiquated in their systems. Hmm. So in the course of, he said, what we did in 6 months would normally take 18 months for any corporation to accomplish. It appears that the FBI, their main job really is to collect and analyze information, and they couldn't do that had before. Yeah. And it's important that we realize how drastically the FBI failed before in their mission because they could not collect and analyze data. But if they are moving in the right direction, then I'll certainly, you know, it's a credit to Director Mueller and all the hardworking FBI agents that are with them today.
Yeah. In the less than a minute that we have left, do you believe the report makes less likely another tragedy like the World Trade Center?
As I said, I have not read the report yet, but it does point towards intelligence failures, and that needs to be addressed. I think the FBI is addressing their intelligence failures. I don't know that the CIA necessarily is. Certainly, George Tenet was in charge. He declared the war a war on terrorism, and in the months before 9/11, talked about all of these enhancements that he had introduced to the CIA to protect us from terrorists, and they had all failed. So I think the CIA is an organization that needs complete analysis and examination. Supposedly all of these agencies are working together. That was another critical factor that was missing.
Right,
before.
Right.
Do I have faith that things have changed? It's good. I want to believe. The trust is probably never going to come back after what happened. But it's up to us, everybody, Americans across the country.
Beverly,
the family.
Beverly, yep. Thanks so much for joining us on this.
All right.
Beverly Eckert. Okay. Beverly Eckert is with the group Voices of September 11, and she spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Well, ending weeks of speculation, the government of Iran confirmed yesterday that it is holding several senior members of the al-Qaeda terrorist network. The announcement from the Iranian intelligence minister was the first such public admission from a top government official and came just days after President Bush accused Iran of harboring terrorists. There have been persistent rumors that Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two man in al-Qaeda, is among those in Iran, but Iran has denied that. Well, Gary Sick is director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University and a longtime Iran watcher. He joins us from New York. And Gary, what do you think? How many top officials do you think are there?
Well, it's virtually impossible to tell. We know that over the last year, Iran has indicated that it has arrested and extradited up to 500 al-Qaeda people from various countries in the Middle East who had fled across the border from Pakistan or Afghanistan. So we know that there's a huge flow going through there. Iran has a very long and quite porous border, even though it tries to stop the drug trade coming across. People can make it across the border. So they've had an influx of people fleeing the American invasion and other things and coming into Iran. One of the top people, a fellow named Abu Ghaith, who was a top spokesman for al-Qaeda, was offered by Iran to be extradited back to Kuwait, and Kuwait refused him. So we know for a fact that he's there. I think actually more interesting is the case of al-Zawahiri, who is an Egyptian, and there are fairly credible reports that Iran has in fact been conducting discussions with the Egyptians about returning him to Egypt.
Well, Gary, tell us this. Remind us, what would the thoughts of Iran be towards the al-Qaeda network?
Iran was very close to being at war with the Taliban and with al-Qaeda at the time of the American invasion. They were, in fact, supporting anti-Taliban operations inside Afghanistan. So Iran's opposition to the Taliban and al-Qaeda is really very clear.
What do you make of Iran's announcement yesterday? Do you think it was in response to pressure from President Bush last week?
My own guess is that this is actually a response to the tremendous publicity beating that Iran has been receiving because of the death of a Canadian reporter who was there, who was taken into custody, died in custody. The Canadian government is withdrawing its ambassador in protest over the way the case has been handled. It has been handled very, very badly by the Iranians. It's clear that they're trying to cover up activities by their own security forces. So that, they're quite sensitive to the fact that they're under attack from even countries like Canada who have been friendly in the past. And I think this may be an effort to make themselves look to be more the good guy rather than the bad guy.
Yeah. And what should we expect in the future? Do you think Iran will go out of its way, this so-called Axis, you know, a member of the Axis of Evil, to demonstrate to the U.S. that it is not friendly with al-Qaeda? Or do you think it will resent being put in that position?
both. What has happened in the recent past is that Iran clearly denies that it has anything to do with al-Qaeda, but at the same time, they indicate that they want nothing to do with the Americans, and they resent the way the Americans are dealing with the issue. And I don't think they've quite resolved themselves, I think, any more than we've resolved exactly where we fall on this thing.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Professor Sick.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Gary Sick is director of Middle East Institute at Columbia University.
Stay with us. More ahead on Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas meets tomorrow with President Bush. And next Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon will also have a White House meeting. Now, on both these visits, much of the talk will be about a Palestinian state, a two-state solution. One Israel, one Palestine, two peoples separated by flags, borders, treaties. Among millions of Palestinians, the idea, the dream of a state of their own is near sacred. But another idea is now increasingly making the rounds, in Palestinian intellectual circles at least. What if it's too late for a separate Palestinian state? What if the better option for Palestinians is to become Israelis? The one-state solution. Well, joining us on the line is Diana Boutu. She's a legal advisor to the PLO, and she's currently in Washington preparing for Prime Minister Abbas's visit with President Bush. Welcome, Diana.
Welcome. Thank you.
Well, Diana, why would any Palestinian not want a state of their own?
Well, it's become increasingly obvious that Israel doesn't want us to have a state of our own. What has been offered in the past at various negotiations was more of a Bantustan-type arrangement or the equivalent of Native American Indian reservations, where the Palestinian state would be surrounded and controlled entirely by Israel, no borders of its own, no independence of its own, and no sovereignty. Israel's never really wanted to have a viable and independent sovereign Palestinian state.
Well, now, wait a minute. There are many Israelis who sincerely want Palestinians to have greater human rights and indeed a state of their own, are there not?
Yes, most certainly there are many Israelis, but I don't think that many Israelis understand what it is that the Israeli government is proposing for the Palestinians.
Well, detail that for me. What do you mean? You're talking about wiring, plumbing, roads, infrastructure?
I'm talking about all of those things. For example, there's a settlement in the northern part of the West Bank, which goes really deep into the heart of it. It's called Ariel. Ariel sits atop a high recharge water aquifer. It's where water comes out the purest, the fastest, and the freshest. Now, unfortunately, the water that comes out of that aquifer, 94% of the water that comes out of that aquifer, and remember, this is the best aquifer in the West Bank, is shipped off into Israel, with leaving the Palestinians with only 6% of the water. The water infrastructure is an Israeli water infrastructure. The electricity infrastructure is an Israeli grid. In the area of Jerusalem, the way the roads have been designed are entirely to connect East Jerusalem to West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem all the way into Israel, with absolutely no thinking about how to connect the Palestinian cities to one another. In fact, they've been excluded from one another. And right now, with the light rail system that Israel is building in East Jerusalem, again, the intent is to simply, through the creation of facts on the ground, annex parts of Palestinian territory into Israel. Now, this is going to create a situation in which it's going to become impossible to have a viable state. Currently, East Jerusalem is the economic trade capital of the occupied West Bank. And without East Jerusalem, it's going to be very difficult to create a Palestinian economy that can subsist and can survive. So although many Israelis themselves want to see a Palestinian state, I don't think many Israelis are quite aware of what it is that Israel is trying to propose for the Palestinians.
Now, part of the appeal, Diana, of a one-state solution is demographics, is it not? Israel already has more than 1 million Arabs inside its borders, aside from the 1 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, and predictions are that by the year 2020, the proportion of Jews between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean will only be about 39%. So the one-state solution is kind of a demographic time bomb for Israelis, is it not?
We need to start talking about equality, and we need to start talking about reconciliation. And if we're simply going to view the Palestinians as a demographic threat or a security threat, that's not going to bring us long-lasting peace. What is going to bring us long-lasting peace is if we recognize that each person is equal and we put into place a series of measures whereby individuals are equal.
Diana, how much of this is a negotiating ploy?
It's actually not a ploy at all. What it is it's facing reality.
Well, no less a personage than former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has said it's only a matter of a year or two before the one-state solution idea becomes much more current than it already is. We will see. And Diana Bhutu, we thank you very much for joining us to discuss it.
Thank you.
Diana Bhutu is legal advisor to the PLO. Well, we turn now to Meir Shlomo. He's Consul General of Israel to New England. And Mr. Shlomo, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Mr. Shlomo, what do you think of this one-state idea now being bruited about in some Palestinian intellectual circles in particular?
Well, I think it's not only that it is a fringe idea, but it's also a ludicrous idea. We are never going to go for this kind of solutions, and I think it's a pity that instead of really challenging and confronting the real problem, some people on the Palestinian side keeps manufacturing all this illusions that will bring us nowhere.
Still, Consul General, Palestinians and Israelis are so interwoven. They're interwoven on the level of employment. They live together on this small parcel of land. Why not one big state?
Well, the reason for why not a big state, one state, is that Israel is always and was established as a Jewish state, a place for a national home for the Jews. And this is the way we would like to keep it. We want to make the Middle East a place where people can live, can have a dream, and can fulfill the dream. And one-state solution is definitely not the way to go about it. And unfortunately,
what if the Palestinians say what it really takes is to remove settlements from the West Bank?
Well, settlements is an issue that we can discuss, but this is only one of the issues. And like I said, the real issues and the major stumbling block is not a settlement, but the will of the Palestinians to pay the price that they need to pay in order to get a peace that we'll be able to preserve and not just a piece of paper.
Just to finish then, Meir, what would happen? Let's just imagine that in a year or two, the Palestinians walk away from the table and they insist on a one-state solution.
Well, you know, history has shown us that the Palestinians have done a lot of mistakes in the past. So it's not entirely impossible that they will come to another mistake. However, I hope both for us and for the Palestinians that they will take the lessons out of history and not repeat the same mistake again and again and again.
Meir Shlomo, thank you very much for making some time for us.
You're welcome.
Meir Shlomo is Consul General of Israel to New England.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a radio talk show host is naming the woman who says she was raped by basketball star Kobe Bryant. Our media panel will weigh in on naming names.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Harvard researchers say the popular prostate cancer test is missing 82% of tumors in men under 60, but they have a suggestion to make it more efficient.
A political cartoonist creates a pro-Bush cartoon, so why did he get a visit from the Secret Service?
And the National Endowment for the Arts takes Shakespeare on the road this fall.
What they're trying to do is go back to like the 18th and 19th century when these little troops would barnstorm around the country to a lot of small cities, you know what I mean? So they get a chance to see some high-quality Shakespeare.
These stories, coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Photos of Saddam Hussein's dead sons have been released 2 days after U.S. officials said they had been killed in an attack in Mosul. Thelma Lebrecht has more from the Pentagon.
The release was not done here at the Pentagon, but by a civilian group in Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority. Pentagon officials say that's an effort to send a civilian message from the region to the Arab world that there is no doubt Odai and Qusay Hussein are dead. The pictures show the faces of both men with full beards, pockmarked with bruises and injuries, and with their eyes shut. A spokesman for the Pentagon insists displaying the photos does not violate provisions of the Geneva Convention.
Three more U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq, bringing the total number of American servicemen killed in action there since March 20th to 158. The soldiers were killed in the northern part of the country when their convoy was hit by gunfire and rocket-fired grenades. And witnesses say two Iraqis were killed in Baghdad when their car approached a U.S. military checkpoint. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers are releasing parts of a report on pre-9/11 intelligence failures. Democratic Senator Bob Graham was asked this morning on the CBS Early Show whether he thought the attacks could have been prevented.
I think the answer is probably yes. The most significant set of events, in my opinion, are in the section of the report that has been censored and therefore won't be available to the American people.
The sections of the report made available today say the CIA, FBI, and other agencies had intelligence but did not share it or follow up on leads. There is heightened security today at New York's City Hall, a day after a gunman was able to bypass security there before shooting a city councilman. Councilman James Davis, a former police officer and ordained minister, was shot several times in the balcony of the council chamber. Mayor Michael Bloomberg says everyone entering the building will now have to go through metal detectors. And California Governor Gray Davis is gearing up for a rough campaign as he prepares for the nation's first gubernatorial recall election in 82 years. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are up. The Dow is ahead 46 points at 9240. The NASDAQ is up 10 points at 1730. And the S&P 500 is up 6. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The most common prostate cancer screening test, a blood test called the PSA, is being questioned today in the New England Journal of Medicine. New research on the test shows that it missed 82% of cancers in men under 60 and 65% of tumors in men over 65. Well, the PSA is now part of the annual physical for men over 50, those with a family history of the disease, and black men over 45, because it's thought that tests showing a PSA level of 4 or above were a surefire indication of a possible problem, an effective way to find and often cure prostate cancer. But researchers are now saying that the PSA number should be lowered, and the test will help find doctors find more tumors if it is. Joining us to talk about the test is Dr. Daniel George, a prostate cancer specialist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And Dr. George, tell us, are you buzzing about this research as much as people here are?
The most common prostate cancer screening test, a blood test called the PSA, is being questioned today in the New England Journal of Medicine. New research on the test claims that it missed 82% of cancers in men under 60 and 65% of tumors in men over 65.
Absolutely, Robin. We're very excited about the findings because I think many of us for a long time have felt that the research that had led to PSA being a very sensitive screen had been somewhat biased by the fact that most patients diagnosed with prostate cancer had a PSA beforehand, and many patients with lower levels of PSA weren't undergoing those diagnostic tests.
Doctor, explain the numbers to us. Why is the number 4 important?
Well, PSA is actually an abbreviation for prostate-specific antigen, so it's a protein that's measured in the blood. And 4 refers to the concentration of that protein. It's actually 4 nanograms per milliliter.
In other words, if you register that number, it shows that your blood has antigens that are fighting, perhaps, cancer.
Well, it's actually showing that that your prostate and your prostate cancer are making that amount of protein in the blood. Antigen just refers to the way we detect it. It's detected by an antibody test. So it's a protein that your cancer and your prostate makes that becomes elevated in certain circumstances. And 4 is a threshold that really comes out of the original studies, sort of based on an older population. And what this study has shown is that for patients who are younger than that, in particular, a lower threshold is more appropriate for screening.
Now, they're saying that perhaps the number 2.6 should be the magic number now.
That's correct.
Wouldn't that open up to a lot more false positives and a lot more painful and unnecessary biopsies?
Well, I think the point is very well taken. There would definitely be a lot more biopsies done. The actual percentage rate of false positives wouldn't change that much, interestingly, but because we'd be diagnosing more cases, there would definitely be more biopsies and more cases diagnosed. Now, the real question here, and I think this is what makes our application of this finding very difficult, is that we've not actually proven yet that PSA screening really improves survival. And those studies probably won't be finished for a couple more years.
But we do know that incidence of deaths from prostate cancer have dropped extraordinarily, and that survival of prostate cancer after it's treated is extraordinarily high. So what are you saying to patients now?
Well, I think those are good points, too. The fact is circumstantially, the evidence would support it, and I think we're all hoping that screening will be a positive finding. But the way we...
Dr. Daniel George is a prostate cancer specialist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Well, turning a corner, political cartoons, they're meant to provoke, and that's just what Los Angeles Times cartoonist Michael Ramirez aims to do. But never did he expect that his latest cartoon would elicit an inquiry by the Secret Service. The cartoon mimics the famous 1968 Vietnam-era photo of a South Vietnamese soldier shooting a Viet Cong in the head. In the Ramirez version, a man labeled Politics is holding a gun to President Bush's head. Well, joining us on the line from Los Angeles is Michael Ramirez. And Michael, what were you trying to say?
Actually, I'm calling in from Gitmo. They only allow me one phone call, so we have to keep this short.
Down in Guantanamo, are you?
That's right.
Well, what were you trying to say?
You know, the image was one of the more powerful images from the Vietnam era. And what I was trying to do with this image, as disturbing as it was to portray, metaphorically speaking, the political assassination of our president with political motivations in dealing with the uranium attack.
In other words, you're defending the president.
Yes.
And along comes the Secret Service. So what did they say to you?
Well, you know, after the strip search, which, I asked for in particular, which I liked, you know, I actually didn't talk to the Secret Service at all, except for one incident early in the morning when this man called me up and he said, I am with the Secret Service. And I said, how do I know that you are with the Secret Service? And he said, well, I've got a black suit, black sunglasses, and credentials. And I really thought it was a crank call. So I said, come on down and make sure you bring your credentials. And sure enough, it turned out to be the Secret Service. And at that time, when my editor found out it was, because of issues dealing with freedom of the press, he was immediately quarantined, and they checked his temperature. And
but Michael, seriously, did they tell you that they didn't want you doing cartoons of this nature, or did they question whether you were going to attack the president?
Well, you know, I didn't talk to the Secret Service because the legal counsel intervened, and she talked to him. But what our general feeling was that along with a routine examination, I guess, of the incident, we'll call it the incident, we had a feeling that they were trying to intimidate or intimate that a political cartoonist shouldn't be doing these kinds of things. And you know, we try not to be obnoxious, and we try not to exaggerate things. And that's not in the nature of editorial cartooning, of course.
I guess there is something a little off-putting about a picture with a gun to the head of the president.
The political cartoon was meant to be a disturbing image because I think the current manifestation of attacks on the president driven by political reasons rather than fact is far more disturbing than anything I could put in a cartoon. You know, we're editorialists like anybody else. Hopefully my cartoons will not only be offensive, but will be insightful and will have a poignant message, because I think that's what the most important element for political cartooning is.
Well, Michael, I just want to ask you one last thing, because you probably do unsettle readers quite a bit. Here you are with a name like Ramirez, and some people might not expect you to support President Bush, just prejudices being what they are.
Well, you know, I get all kinds of really nasty emails all the time saying that I'm betraying my culture and stuff like that. You know, political cartooning is about dealing with issues rather than personalities. And we go beyond the realm of, you know, some broad philosophical idea or some partisan politics. You know, if I'm a member of any party, it would be the anti-stupid party. You know, we're equal opportunity offenders.
Yeah.
I deal with the issues and the merits of those issues, and whoever happens to be in the target sites deserves it, regardless if they're Republicans or Democrats or whatnot.
I think it's really funny that you occasionally, according to what I've read, even though you, for instance, are supportive of President Bush, you've gotten emails from his detractors saying, racist scum, go back to Tijuana, you wetback.
You know, that was just from my mom. It's really disturbing.
Well, Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
Michael Ramirez, political cartoonist for the Los Angeles Times. To see the cartoon we've been talking about, go to our website, here-now.org. Still to come, from main streets to big-time stages, he's all over the place. We'll talk Shakespeare, the man, with our man, Bill Marks.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's Thursday when we open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We received several emails critical of our interview with Dr. Rosalie Petalino Porter, a supporter of the Massachusetts Initiative passed by voters last year, which replaces bilingual education with full English immersion. Dr. Porter is connected with the man who led the national fight against bilingual education, Ron Unz. And Emilio Honorato, who teaches English as a second language at Boston University, wrote, "The real story here is about a misinformed public that was led astray by an outsider. Ron Unz's crusade is more about furthering his own right-wing political agenda than it is about educating immigrant children."
Well, Laura Slitt from Bartlett, New Hampshire, wrote, responding to news of American troops in Iraq and possibly now on their way to Liberia. She asks, why are we in other nations militarily instead of humanitarily? Why do we spend the lion's share on defense instead of providing a just agricultural policy that allows for indigenous peoples to grow crops, to feed themselves, and use water for humans?
Here and Now film critic Eric Schaefer got a lot of mail after he said the Akira Kurosawa film Yojimbo was inspired by a Dashiell Hammett novel, The Glass Key. Ron Dingman pointed out that the movie more closely resembled an earlier Hammett novel, Red Harvest. Well, Hammett fans, Eric says, some sources point to one book, others point to the other, and Kurosawa never said.
Robert Mueller of Hollis, New Hampshire, called about Robin's interview with Leonard Leo. He helped start a group called NGO Watch to to monitor non-governmental organizations such as Amnesty International. Mr. Mueller appreciated our questioning about NGO co-founder, the American Enterprise Institute.
She not only identified him as a conservative outfit, often they're simply quoted as the gospel from Washington, but asked him to be a little more transparent about his interest in the whole thing. I thought that a very good interview and a most appropriate approach.
Finally, we received a lot of music requests. Several Rhode Islanders asked about the song following our piece on the Rhode Island-Connecticut border dispute. It's Blossom Dearie's Rhode Island is Famous for You from the CD The Diva Series.
And you come from Rhode Island, and little old Rhode Island is famous for you.
And Andy Caton of Philadelphia and others asked about the song following our poetry challenge. He says he can't get it out of his head. Well, it's Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. It's available on the album of the same name.
Well, this reminder, the deadline on the Postcard Poems Challenge has been extended to Monday. You have time to call upon the muse, so check out our website for the rules.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or give a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please, please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Starting this fall, the National Endowment for the Arts brings Shakespeare to Main Street. It's a project called Shakespeare in American Communities, a 100-city tour throughout the country, playing in theaters in small and mid-sized cities. But the Bard is blossoming beyond Main Street, too, in the second half of 2003. And joining me in the studio now to talk about the NEA project and other evidence of Shakespeare's undying art and appeal is Here and Now's theater critic, Bill Marks. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
So, Bill, tell me about this NEA project.
Well, it's an extremely ambitious project, and it's a partnership with Arts Midwest, where major theater companies from Minneapolis, Oregon, Little Rock, Chicago, New York are involved in presenting some plays by Shakespeare. They include Richard III, Othello, Romeo and Juliet, and A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Unusual, this tour?
It's unusual to the extent that, you know, what they're trying to do is go back to, like, the 18th and 19th century when these little troops would barnstorm throughout, you can remember the famous scene in Huckleberry Finn, for example, where you have the two sort of retrobate Shakespearean actors.
Yeah.
And so they're taking these Shakespeare companies, and essentially, because the NEA has been in such political hot water lately, I think this is an attempt by a new chairman.
A little mainstreaming.
A little mainstreaming to take something that's safe, who can say anything bad about Shakespeare, and basically to take it a around the country to a lot of small cities. You know what I mean? So they get a chance to see some high-quality Shakespeare, and the NEA can do something that nobody can criticize.
Well, whatever the motivation, it sounds like a great idea. Now, of course, it's summertime, and that means Shakespeare in the Park, Shakespeare festivals. Tell us briefly what's happening on that score. Alex.
Well, I mean, briefly. I mean, every county seems to have its own Shakespeare festival.
Amazing, isn't it?
Somebody in some basement somewhere, somebody's rehearsing Shakespeare at every moment of day or night. Next month in North Carolina, they're going to be doing a Hamlet in the Boston Common here in Boston. They're going to be doing a Macbeth very soon. It's going to open momentarily. And in Oregon, in the Shakespeare Festival there, they've been doing an Antony and Cleopatra, and that's going to continue through November. But that's only scratching the surface of all the bard that's getting done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's Shakespeare on the stage as he was meant to be performed. What else is up with Shakespeare this summer?
Particularly interesting for me has been a new book out, which is called Shakespeare at the Cineplex, the Kenneth Branagh era. And essentially the thesis of this book by Samuel Crowell is after Henry V, which was produced by Kenneth Branagh, you know, the film was made in 1989, there was an explosion of Shakespeare on film more than any other time in the century. Suddenly you had Henry V, then you had Branagh's Much Ado About Nothing, and then so many other films following that. And he essentially goes chapter by chapter trying to explain, well, why this explosion of Shakespeare right in 1989 at the end of the Cold War, and did it perhaps end with 9/11? And the person, of course, he credits it all to is Kenneth Branagh. The Henry V, which he says made war sort of respectable. And then, of course, there's the Much Ado About Nothing, which for a lot of people made Shakespeare sexy and vibrant and alive. You know, it's set in Italy. And you've got Kenneth Branagh presenting the verse and the visuals in a way in which they complement each other perfectly.
It must be requited. I hear how I am censured. They say I will bear myself proudly if I perceive the love come from her. They say, too, that she will rather die than give any sign of affection. I did never think to marry.
Shakespeare that's glossy and sexy and fun.
Yeah, I mean, the idea here is to take, and what Crowell says is essentially, we're getting an, I don't want to say an American flavor, let's say a Hollywood-flavored Shakespeare, to the extent the language is lively and energetic and very understandable. The images are not self-conscious in and of themselves, a la Orson Welles, you know, where you don't know whether you're supposed to be listening to the language or looking at the beautiful pictures. So for Crowell, Branagh's completely typifies or represents the best of taking Hollywood storytelling, all the razzmatazz and all the memories of old movies, and marrying them with a deep respect for the text.
Well, speaking of razzmatazz, what else does author Samuel Crowell mention films in his book?
Well, he mentions 15 major films. He uses Branagh's films, the ones I've mentioned, along with Hamlet and Love's Labour's Lost. I mean, they're sort of the central ones. He also brings up the sort of the MTV Eyes version of William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, where it was all one long music video.
That's
a lot of
people
really adored that one.
Yeah.
And he also talks about other films which, in a sense, take it beyond the Branagh sort of balance that I talked about, a respect for images and respect for the script, for the verse. Titus is, I think, one of his favorite films, which is directed by Julie Taymor, who also, of course, put together The Lion King on Broadway. And he realizes, and he does say that, you know, there's a lot of the imagery is sort of very self-conscious and overwhelming. It's a beautiful film to look at. I also like it, and he does too, because, again, it's not the usual mainstream Shakespeare. I mean, this is Titus Andronicus, an early Shakespeare, which is as bloody, gory, and out there as you can go. Yet she also marries that with a very respectful and very almost conversational approach to the verse. Here, for example, you can hear Anthony Hopkins. He plays Titus Andronicus, the king whose sons are being killed off one by one in a very grisly way. And he's just about, his wits are leaving him. And she sets this scene as he's sitting in a bathtub.
Who doth molest my contemplation? Is it your trick to make me open the door? Then so my sad decrees may fly away, and all my study be to no effect. Ah! You are deceived for what I mean to do. See here, in bloody lines, I have set down. And what is written shall be executed.
That ain't much ado about nothing.
No, that ain't much. Visually, it's quite a wonderful scene where he's sort of sitting in this stone tub. And also, she can use close-ups to bring you closer to him, and you can hear him splashing in the water. I mean, there's everything there but the rubber ducky. That I would have loved to have seen, but that's not there. But Crowell likes that because she's willing to use visuals in a way, not forget the text, but really to go a little bit wild and a bit surreal. And a lot of the films of Branagh and the other Shakespeare films that were done in Hollywood are more realistic and naturalistic.
I'm still thinking through that rubber ducky, but let's move on. We've talked about stage, film, this new book. What about TV?
The BBC is doing a new documentary called In Search of Shakespeare. I assume someone is going to distribute it here. I hope they do. It sounds pretty interesting. And on these shores, the A&E, later on this month, is going to be showing Ethan Hawke as Hamlet in a film version that was made in the year 2000.
Right.
And this is a very sort of quirky, experimental, non-Branagh sort of a production, where it's set in New York, gleaming surfaces of New York City, corporate corruption seething in all of the shadows. The Hamlet's father materializes out of a Pepsi machine. That's one of my favorites. He just sort of comes out of it, just sort of wanders out of it.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of quirky, comic sort of, you're not quite sure. I think they're taking Hamlet earnestly, but there's a lot of postmodern irony and cool in
it. Did it work for you?
Well, it did work for me. At times, it just seems to be more clever than insightful. But for example, one of my favorite moments is the to be and not to be soliloquy, which Ethan Hawke delivers. Always dangerous. He delivers it walking in the action aisle of a Blockbuster video store.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them, to die, to sleep, no more.
He sounds a little bit as if he's already asleep there, frankly. I mean, it's a very innovated Hamlet. You know, he might be contemplating suicide, but he's doing it in a very sort of faddishly innovated way.
Well, a very rich summer and fall for Shakespeare lovers this 2003. Bill Marks, thanks very much for being here to tell us all about it.
Thanks, Bill.
Here in Now's theater critic Bill Marks for more information on the performances and films we talked about. And if you want to look at the book, Shakespeare at the Cineplex, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Our media panel weighs in on the issue.
Here and Now.
Our media panel weighs in on the issue.